Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
Los Angeles, get ready for the mother of all traffic jams. Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is Which Way LA, KCIW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Local drivers who think they've seen traffic congestion are in for a weekend that could break records, if anyone's keeping track. This coming July, from Sherman Oaks to Bel Air, the San Diego Freeway will be shut down from midnight Friday till 5 a.m. Monday in both directions. How will 500,000 vehicles get through the Sepulveda Pass? Also tonight, can cities and counties help to keep parks open after the state shuts them down? Later on, political change and continuing conflict in the Middle East. First, here's the news. We're Manali back with Which Way LA on KCRW. With Middle Eastern regimes under challenge as never before, are the Palestinians adopting a new strategy in their struggle with Israel? How will President Obama respond to claims that the U.S. is losing influence in the region? We'll look for some answers later on. First, the L.A. Times carried a story this morning that was good for instant headlines worldwide. Arnold Schwarzenegger fathered a child by a household staff member before he was elected governor. The staff member retired in January, and Schwarzenegger said his wife, Maria Shriver, moved out of their Brentwood estate when he told her sometime after leaving the governorship. In a statement made pointedly on her own, Shriver called it heartbreaking. Joe Matthews is a fellow at the New America Foundation. He's author of The People's Machine, Arnold Schwarzenegger and the Rise of Blockbuster Democracy. Joe Matthews, always, as always, welcome.
Great to be with you, Warren.
You wrote about the governor's public life, not about his private life. Is this a public betrayal as well as a private betrayal?
Well, it's very much a private betrayal. I'm not sure it qualifies as a public betrayal, as strange as that may sound. I watched this guy every day campaign in 2003, interviewed him, talked, and this, he did not speak in the language of public moralism. This was not a fellow who promised us that he was going to be good or safe or follow the rules. He was fairly broad but nonspecific about the fact that he hadn't always behaved well towards people of the opposite sex or people or in his marriage. So I think, there have been a number of public figures who sort of tried to portray their marriages as perfect and great models and emblems. He made his marriage a public document, but in a different way. He was someone who clearly behaved badly in the past. There was a lot in the public record. And the people of California, bought it. And this is clearly part of what came with it. This may be worse than we expected, but he certainly did not promise to be an angel, and he wasn't.
Of course, there were a number of stories in the Los Angeles Times right before his first election about groping women and that sort of thing. And Maria Shriver at that time was extremely supportive.
She was. But remember, the stories were... there was a broad sort of statement that I read, at least at the time, of it as an admission, where he talked about, well, there's smoke, there's fire, he's behaved badly. He was very unspecific about all the bad things he had done. But there was not from that beginning, I'm a pure guy, I'm the perfect family man. Those are not the types of things we heard from him. And when you, even in his way of talking about policy and governance, he was moralistic only in saying that he was going to try to sort of do the right thing in policy, away from pressures of partisanship and money. So I think in some ways, something like the commutation of Esteban Nunez, is the son of the speaker, Fabian Nunez, is a friend of Schwarzenegger's. That is actually more of a public, you could argue, it was a public betrayal, because there he was. He seemed to be favoring a friend, and that was the sort of thing he promised not to do. He didn't promise to be personally well-behaved. It made no representation that he was always personally well-behaved.
Of course, both he and Maria Shriver were public figures going in. He, the action hero. She, the reporter on NBC News.
They were, and I think this is a professionally damaging thing to both of them, because they both sold as public figures this narrative of this marriage, which was a struggle, but where, you know, these two very different people of different political persuasions, backgrounds, born in, you know, different countries, sort of managed to, whatever their many problems, sort of hold it together. And that was a narrative that had lots of value for him politically. It's a narrative that's, you know, part of many of her best-selling books. And if they lose this marriage, they lose a narrative and a professional partnership that's very valuable to both. This is not just a marriage disintegrating. This is a sort of a business arrangement as well.
How important was she to his first election and his second election, for that matter? Do the people of California care about these kinds of reports?
You know, I think it's certainly titillating and interesting, and I think their marriage was important in the sense that, you know, people had a sense that he wasn't always the greatest guy, but if she could live with him, you know, maybe he would, you know, the rest of us could too. I think, you know, in a very Democratic state, she gave him, as a Republican, a different quality, a different profile in a state where it's very hard for Republicans to win. I think she's vital. And then in the reality of managing a lot of political campaigns, both for himself and for ballot measures, and in deciding a lot of policy into budget details, she was really a force and a partner in working with him. I mean, this is a breakup of much more than a marriage of two people who are the parents of four children.
He obviously took a risk running for governor when he knew, of course, that this child had already been born.
He did. It's a striking risk, but he is a person who in his life has taken lots and lots of risks. I mean, a person who left home, left his country, left everyone he knew at a very young age. I mean, this is not a guy who is scared to take risks, and this was certainly quite a risk. This has been discovered. But at the same point, you know, I'm not sure we should be so surprised that this went undiscovered. You know, according to reports, the woman in question, the House employee in question, was married at the time of this. So both she and Governor Schwarzenegger had plenty of reasons not to tell anyone, and it's quite possible they didn't tell anybody.
All right, Joe Matthews, a fellow at the New America Foundation, author of The California Crackup most recently, and a book about Arnold Schwarzenegger, The People's Machine. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Pleasure.
I'll be right back with Which Way L.A.
You're listening to Which Way L.A., KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Warren Olney also hosts To the Point about issues of national concern. Weekdays at noon on KCRW, distributed nationwide by Public Radio International.
Warren Olney back with Which Way L.A. Short-term pain means long-term gain. That's what Metro says about its four-year, $1 billion addition of a carpool lane to the San Diego Freeway from the 10 on the west side to the 101 in the valley. But two weekends may cause more pain than the rest of the project put together. One weekend this year, one next. The first occasion will last from midnight Friday, July 15th, until 5 a.m. until the following Monday. The 405 will be shut down in both directions through the Sepulveda Pass. Doug Failing is Executive Director of Metro's Highway Project Delivery. Doug Failing, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Warren. It's good to be here with you.
You're trying to get the word out, remembering the 1984 Olympics, when everybody said there was going to be a lot of traffic jams, but because we were prepared in advance, there weren't.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, we've gone through this before here in Southern California. We've had big events. The 84 Olympics are a great one to remember, how we all worked together as Southern California got the word out and were able to make adjustments. But, you know, things happen here all the time. We've had the recent tunnel fire up on I-5. We had all the earthquakes. We have experience with things like the Bay Bridge closures up in the Bay Area over long weekends. So we've done this before, and the key is to start early and to, you know, to be on important programs like your program, getting the word out.
Well, first of all, what will those people have to do who have no choice but to drive through the Sepulveda Pass with the 405 shut down?
Oh, there are a number of detour routes, and we'll be looking at using all the changeable message signs, getting word out as early to people as we can on those that do have to drive. Key is, for those of you that can, take the 101, come downtown, pick up the 10 freeway, and come back out on the 10 freeway. There's a great detour that'll take care of most of the people that have to to do that if you have to go from the San Fernando Valley to the west side. Sepulveda Boulevard itself will be open during this time. Leave yourself lots of extra time and, you know, whatever you can, figure out how you're going to avoid the trip. And be aware that we're working with everyone as early as we can to help get people out of your way.
You're talking about detours on routes that are already very congested, so this is going to have a region-wide impact.
Absolutely a region-wide impact, yes. That's why we have to do this early. The 405 is such a critical corridor in Los Angeles. It's that last major north-south freeway on the west till you hit the ocean. It's a big concentration of traffic between the San Fernando Valley and the west side. Services some great venues all the way from LAX, you know, up through Van Nuys Airport. So, yes, it is an important corridor for us, and getting the word out early is absolutely critical.
What's been happening since the project opened so far? Have people been commuting on it less? Is traffic down? Are they choosing other routes?
No, we've seen a good spread on traffic. We have some traffic techniques out there. We're doing enhanced freeway service patrol. During the peak period, we do have the same number of lanes, although for those of you like me that have had a chance to drive it is narrower lanes, and you've got the K-rails on all sides creating the work zones for the workers. So we haven't seen an overall change in traffic pattern in this corridor as of yet. It has spread a bit, obviously, and it has slowed down a little bit. But for the most part, we're real pleased. People seem to be working together well, and the project is moving really well.
And, of course, the reason for closing the freeway down for all that time on the July weekend is because of the bridge on Mulholland Drive.
Yeah, absolutely. So this particular weekend, what we'll be doing is taking down one half of the bridge up at Mulholland Drive. And, you know, as we start breaking the concrete and bringing those big beams down, it would be absolutely unconscionable for us to try and let traffic be driving underneath when we have those big weights and those big things moving. It just wouldn't be safe. So, again, we've done this before. We actually did it up on the 210 freeway in Arcadia when we took the old light rail bridge out of the freeway up there as well, where we were able to close the freeway over a weekend. Take traffic around using some detour routes, you know, the other freeways that were available, and make great progress. Let the contractor get in there, take the half the bridge down, make the roadway safe again, and then reopen it to traffic.
I know you're doing a lot of stuff up there in addition to building the new carpool lane, fixing up accesses and entries, bridges like the Mulholland Bridge, sound walls, and all that sort of thing. But the major purpose, as I understand it, is this carpool lane. How much is that going to really help traffic?
This last piece of northbound carpool lane on the 405 freeway from the 10 to 101 is very important. It's the last critical link for a carpool lane on the 405 freeway. When this is done, we'll have continuous carpool lanes from I-5 in the San Fernando Valley all the way down through Los Angeles and Orange County, bypassing the major metropolitan area completely with carpool lanes. This is the only link like this that will be continuous in Southern California. In addition to that, I mean, you can't lose the importance of something else you said, the access points. Being able to have a much better interchange at Sunset and a hugely improved interchange at Wilshire Boulevard, plus an additional through lane for mixed flow traffic southbound on 405 underneath the 10 freeway are all very critical elements of what we're gaining out of this project.
Isn't the lesson we've all learned, though, that when you build it, they will come? Won't more people be driving on it simply because it's improved?
Not necessarily. You know, here in Los Angeles, we didn't build for many, many years. And what happened is we created this thing called latent demand. So because the freeway was full, people went over and they started filling up the adjacent city streets. So Sepulveda gets full. All the other parallels going north and south end up getting filled as traffic spills out further and further. When you do improve the freeway and you're able to get more traffic through, yes, we do see traffic backfilling on that. But guess what? That's traffic that's coming off on the adjacent city street. So it does make a good improvement overall for people. And these are critical systems. The whole system has to work together. The freeways are a piece of it. signal synchronization that we're doing and funding at Metro on a number of the city street systems, plus our improvements in the transit system, all have to work together.
Doug Failing, Metro's Executive Director of Highway Project Delivery. Bart Reed is Executive Director of the nonprofit Transit Coalition. Bart Reed, good to have you on our program.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, thank you. This is about the last opportunity to widen the 405. What if the traffic is still bad in years to come? What's your solution to the increased amount of congestion?
Well, simply put, the voters last in 2008 approved Measure R, and one of the Measure R projects is an undefined project called the 405 Corridor Project, where there's over $1 billion allocated to do something on the 405 corridor. You have possible options, for example, bus rapid transit that would go over the freeway, probably wouldn't be much faster than the existing bus line, and the buses wouldn't be more powerful than the existing buses. You could put light rail over the freeway. But we've looked at one option that really is appealing. It could carry up to 100,000 people a day, and that would be a rail tunnel between Westwood, UCLA, and Van Nuys and Ventura Boulevard, making its way up to the Orange Line on Van Nuys Boulevard. A direct linear path would have a huge appetite. The UCLA campus, as many know, it has the first, third, fifth, seventh, ninth, and 11th largest parking structures on the planet. And so there's a huge appetite. Students like to have choice. Faculty likes to have choice. With the Purple Line coming to Westwood, by the time this project is ready to go, you would essentially be able to get from the Valley to Westwood, then you'd be able to continue your journey on the Purple Line, to either towards Santa Monica or towards Beverly Hills, Westwood, Century City, and points eastward to the network.
And that's already funded, you're saying, by Measure R, the sales tax measure?
It's not entirely funded because the project hasn't been entirely developed yet. It's a matter of choice. Lots of times the public has to look at the various options and hone in on the one they like better. If you could have a trip, it's 6 miles, the subway, and the 4 miles between North Hollywood, Universal City, and Hollywood. It's 4 miles. It takes about 4 minutes to get between those two points. Therefore, the 6 miles between UCLA, Westwood, and Van Nuys Ventura is about 6 miles or 6 minutes. So no matter what kind of trip you go across the 405 parking lot, you're 20, 30, 60 minutes, sometimes 2 hours. It just depends on the flavor of the day.
Okay, Bart Reed with the Transit Coalition. Doug Failing, back to you. Is that a good idea? Is that something that people ought to consider seriously?
I've often said that 405 corridor is one of the most critical we have in the Los Angeles area. The idea of the transit corridor that Bart just described is a great project. It's really something that needs to be pursued and followed. You know, my more immediate concern, though, is it's obviously not going to be ready this July, you know, or the next year. So, but it's a great project. It has to be pursued. So for those of you that are out there following the 405, you know, keep updated and make sure you're looking at our website, www.metro.net/i-405.
So you think the rail tunnel, though, would be a good idea?
Excellent idea. Anything like that in the 405 corridor is a great idea, and I personally think that's just an excellent idea.
Bart Reed, quickly, more on the funding. It would take more than $1 billion.
That's true. Last year we presented the idea to the local Congress member, Brad Sherman, and there's lots of times we come up with ideas where people say, why didn't you think of this earlier? But the 405 project came about that's currently going to close down the freeway this summer, in many, many public hearings that we attended, people were always asking, like, why can't there be a rail line between the Valley and West L.A.?
Well, let me go to Doug Failing. Why not? Why didn't you put a rail line in there?
We are looking at a rail line. The project we're doing right now is an HOV lane completion of the system network for the HOV, so that's a very critical element as well. But in Measure R, we at Metro also did fund this initial money to begin the feasibility study for this rail line. It's a great corridor. It does need to get pursued. I know when we were designing this project, and Bart talked about how, you know, they've looked at grade rail, and he thinks this tunnel's a really good idea. I know that when we were designing that project, we made sure that there was room so that someone who did want to do a surface route, there would be places for columns and things to build it. So it is a good project, whether it's in the tunnel or at surface, and we're allowing for it.
Okay, very quickly, once more, so people can keep track of what's happening between now and July. Your website again, Doug Failing?
Our website is www.metro.net/I-405. Keep up on traffic. We're looking forward to working with you.
Okay, and stay home on July 15th. Doug Failing, good to have you with us. Bart Reed as well. We'll be right back with Which Way LA.
For more information about Which Way LA or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayla. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on Which Way LA. California has more state parks than any other state, 258 of them. In order to save money, the state is going to close 70 parks to all visitors starting early next year. A couple of questions occur. How did they choose which ones to shut down, and can they really keep people out? Ruth Coleman is director of the State Department of Parks and Recreation. Ms. Coleman, thank you for joining us.
Great. Nice to be here.
How did you choose those 70 out of the 258?
It's 278 parks, actually.
278, okay.
Yeah, and it is the biggest state park system in the country. We went through a fairly extensive process internally with our senior management, and the park professionals looked at a number of different factors, and each factor was sort of balanced against each other. So I can't say that there was a specific formula, because remember, we are comparing very extraordinary, unique resources against each other. And one thing I always like to say is if you've seen one state park, you have seen one state park. So we are comparing, you know, apples, oranges, and bananas. But nonetheless, we looked at issues like statewide significance, the relative significance of a park. We have a number of different surveys that have been done over the decades as our state park system has been developed. For example, there is a state park survey of 1928 that was authored by Frederick Law Olmsted Jr., the son of the man who designed Central Park. And the California Commission at that time hired him for a year to go across California back in the early 20s and identify the iconic landscapes that should be preserved. And we have, in the ensuing 50 years, protected almost every one of those iconic landscapes, and they're all in our state park system. So we wanted to preserve those particular parks. We also looked at things like visitation. We looked at parks that are on the on the California State History Plan. We want to tell the significant stories of California. So even if a park had fairly low visitation, if it told a really significant historic story, like this is a place where gold was discovered, then those parks we left on the open list. We looked at the fiscal strength, that is, what is the revenues that we earn from the park. We looked at issues like, can you physically close it? Some parks you really physically can, and none of them are easy, but some are harder than others. We looked at partnerships. Do we have concession operations already underway? We looked at the condition of infrastructure. We looked at things like deed restrictions. So you can see there's a number of different variables here that all sort of had to go into play. And so at the end of the day, with this list of 70, as painful as it is for us, we are preserving about 92% of our current attendance levels, and we will also preserve about 94% of our current revenues. So we try to really hang on to the most visited parks that generate the most revenue, but we also were able to save almost 80% of our outstanding representative habitat parks. We're saving about 90% of our most significant cultural parks. So we really try to be very thoughtful with this, which is not to say that the parks on the list aren't important. They all are. They wouldn't be part of the state park system. It's just, you know, when you have to make choices, this is sort of where we came down.
Can cities and counties help the state keep some of these open if they have the resources to do it?
Absolutely. Under current law, we can enter into operating agreements with cities and counties. In fact, 10% of those 278 parks in our system today are operated by counties. And in your listening area in Southern California, things like Dockweiler State Beach is operated by the county, but it's owned by state parks. Kenneth Hahn is a state park, but it's operated by the county of LA. And so we are absolutely eagerly looking for partners who could expand that list. Now, sadly, a lot of the parks that we're looking at closing are in rural counties, which are extremely impoverished right now. Some of them have unemployment rates in the 15% range. And so it may be very challenging for them because they're also struggling financially, as are a lot of cities. But the extent to which any of the cities, counties, or other park districts, any other government entity, national parks also, we are eagerly looking for expanded partnerships, and the law allows that right now.
In Southern California, you didn't close any beach parks, as I understand it. You did close some of the historical sites, Pico Pico, Antelope Valley, Indian Museum, and also the Salton Sea. A lot of people go to the Salton Sea. How do you keep them out of there?
Well, we would be closing as our part of the Salton Sea, which is the campground. And so that's what would be closed. But obviously there's a lot of other parts of the Salton Sea where people can get access to it that are privately operated.
What about the Redwoods? Henry Coe, Portola Redwoods, Samuel P. Taylor Estate Park. Redwoods are pretty important to the history of California.
They are extremely important. And but I would also point out we're retaining a lot of our Redwood parks as well. Humboldt Redwoods and the whole Redwood National State Park system is being left open. And so, and the first Redwood Grove ever preserved is Calaveras Big Trees, and also Big Basin Redwoods, and both of those are big iconic parks are remaining. So you're right. We do own a lot of Redwood parks, and we tried to save some of the big ones, and sadly we do have a few on the closure list. Some of them do have campgrounds, and so we're hoping that maybe we'll be able to find concessionaires who might help step up, or nonprofit entities. If we can find nonprofits to work with, okay, we would have to go to the legislature for authority for that. But, you know, we're really, really eagerly looking for creative ways to keep some of these parks open.
Very quickly, closures this summer. Will they be safe until next year?
Absolutely. All these parks will be closed by next July, not 2011, but July 2012. And the actual closure dates, it'll be kind of a rolling thing, and it'll probably be later in the year. And so it'll vary by park, but we aren't closing anything through the summer at all.
Okay, sad story, however you look at it. Ruth Coleman, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Director of the Department of Parks and Recreation for the State of California. You can join the conversation on our Which Way LA Facebook page. In a moment, political change and continuing conflict in the Middle East on Which Way LA. Warman Alney back with Which Way LA. The nightmare scenario that Israel has feared since its establishment has come true. The barrier of fear has been broken. Those are Israeli commentators on what Defense Minister Ehud Barak describes as the Palestinians' transition from suicide bomber terrorism to mass demonstrations deliberately unarmed. They're all quoted in a Washington Post article by Joel Greenberg in Jerusalem. Joel, good to have you on our program.
Good to be on the show.
This comes in the aftermath of events on this past Sunday. Tell us about those and why we're getting these rather disturbed-sounding comments from Israeli commentators.
Well, what happened basically on Sunday was that the Arab Spring that's sweeping the Middle East landed on Israel's doorstep, basically through Facebook groups and other connections. Mass demonstrations were organized simultaneously, coordinated, from four directions, walking, marching on borders where there are Israeli soldiers, from Syria, from Lebanon, from the Gaza Strip, and also from inside the West Bank. And in one location, near the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights, the demonstrators from Syria managed to breach the border fence and enter a village in that area. So this was something unprecedented, really, in size and in coordination, and it took the Israelis by surprise, and it really took them aback because it cuts to the heart of the conflict, the issue of Palestinian refugees wanting to return to their homes inside Israel, which Israelis, of course, see as an existential threat to their country.
Now, there were some killings by Israeli soldiers of Palestinian demonstrators, but Mr. Barak is saying this is a challenge, a kind of challenge that is not so simple. What does he mean by that?
Well, Israeli soldiers, of course, most of them in these locations are combat soldiers. They're trained to shoot armed adversaries, and they're not trained in riot control or crowd control. And the problem that these soldiers had, they were outnumbered, they were unprepared. And in the end, there were a large number of fatalities in one location on the Lebanese border. There were 10 people killed. And on the Syrian front, there were at least two, as many as four killed at the Golan Heights. And again, this was a matter that of the soldiers not being trained to deal with this kind of activity. And they were not equipped with non-lethal riot control equipment. So they used live ammunition. And this is a problem. The Israeli army is going to have to adjust to this. And they claim that they've already started as a result of the mass demonstrations across the Arab world.
So when one commentator in Haaretz says the nightmare scenario that Israel has feared since its establishment came true, they're talking about Palestinians en masse just walking across the border and reclaiming their homes.
Right. That's kind of the fantastic image that, of course, nobody thought would actually materialize. But in this case, it actually happened, where you have thousands of Palestinians literally marching on the Israeli border from different directions. Now, of course, this is not as frightful as it may sound. Clearly, these people are unarmed. Israel has heavily armed troops and patrols on all the borders. It's not a security threat, I would say, of any dimension. But it's more of a there's a certain moral force to it. There's a political power to it that is disconcerting to many Israelis.
What about the coordination? Did that derive from the unity pact between Fatah and Hamas?
No, Hamas was not really involved in this. This was very much kind of the popular organization that we saw in other countries like Egypt using social network, Facebook, various tools like that. There are also other ways to communicate, of course, but the idea was to have a coordinated activity, and this was really unprecedented, a coordinated activity of such dimensions at the same time from various directions. It should be noted that this day, the Nakba Day, which commemorates Israel's establishment and the Palestinian displacement and the war that followed Israel's establishment, has been marked by rallies every year, but this was the first time there were demonstrations on such a scale from so many directions coming toward Israel's borders.
This, of course, was the 63rd anniversary of that event. There is some claim that Bashar Assad in Syria might have been behind what happened at the border with the Golan Heights in order to distract attention from what's going on within his country. What's the evidence for that?
Well, that was something that Israeli officials immediately charged, and the U.S. has said the same. Clearly, there were Syrian soldiers there. They did not prevent the marchers from going across the border and from breaching the border fence into Israeli-held territory on the Golan Heights. So there was no attempt by the Syrian authorities to stop this. And in fact, I've heard reports that a lot of this was coordinated. These people came from a refugee camp in Damascus. None of this could happen in Syria without the authorities knowing about it and condoning it, if not encouraging it. So the organization may have been grassroots. It might have been organized by people in different places, Palestinians. But clearly the government in Syria was aware and did not stop it and did nothing to get in their way.
Is there concern on the part of the Israelis that this might happen again? And if so, is there any particular day on which it's more likely than others?
Well, the Israelis actually were preparing for this Nakba Day, but they were expecting more trouble in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. They're more accustomed to dealing with Palestinian protests inside these areas. What they did not expect was it to come from the direction of Syria. The border between the Golan Heights and Syria has been quiet for decades. They were prepared for something on the Lebanese border. So, yes, the army is preparing for replays of this, especially in September, when the Palestinians intend to go to the United Nations and ask for recognition of Palestinian statehood in the General Assembly. So there are expected to be large demonstrations after that happens. And the Israelis saw Sunday as a kind of dress rehearsal for what may come again in the coming months.
Jill Greenberg, once again, a correspondent for The Washington Post, based in Jerusalem. At the White House today, President Obama met with King Abdullah of Jordan and spoke briefly afterwards to reporters.
We both share the view that despite the many changes, or perhaps because of the many changes that are taking place in the region, it's more vital than ever that both Israelis and Palestinians find a way to get back to the table and begin negotiating a process whereby they can create two states that are living side by side in peace and security.
Laura Rosen is senior foreign policy reporter for Yahoo News. Laura Rosen, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
George Mitchell has left the administration as the president's special envoy to Israel and the Palestinians. What kind of progress can the president point to when he says what we just heard him say?
I think that they do concede that they've had an uphill struggle in trying to get a peace process going between the Israelis and Palestinians, as much as you know, the president reasserted today, you know, his view that it's imperative. And what's interesting is in the past couple weeks before this Nakba Day, you know, events in Israel that Joel was just describing, the Obama administration had decided to essentially separate out Obama's comments later this week on the Arab Spring from a larger U.S. initiative that's now expected to come later this summer on trying to get the parties back to the peace table. And so, you know, the latest events from Sunday, you know, give them pause once again to determine if they made a mistake, you know, easing pressure up a little bit when the parties seem so averse to coming back to talks right now.
So were there any hints in what the president said today after meeting with the King of Jordan about what he is liable to say in this speech that he's going to make on Thursday, big billed by some as a Cairo 2?
You know, I think there will be one element of that Arab Spring speech that, you know, reasserts the U.S. position that the only way to settle this dispute, the Israeli-Palestinian dispute, is through negotiations between the parties. That is something that Netanyahu is going, the Israeli Prime Minister, will be telling Congress and the American Israel Public Affairs Committee in the coming days. It's a position that he and Obama share. Obama has also decided to address AIPAC, which he has not done since 2008, presidential campaign. So I don't think it will be the Israel-Palestine issue will be mentioned in a few graphs, but not be the larger focus of the Arab Spring, Cairo 2 remarks.
Laura Rosen again at Yahoo News. Jim Galvin is professor in history at UCLA. He's author of many books, including The Israeli-Palestinian Conflict, 100 Years of War, and a forthcoming book on the Arab Uprising. Professor Galvin, good to have you on our show.
Thank you for having me.
What about the effort in September at the United Nations by the Palestinians to get the General Assembly to declare that there is, in fact, a Palestinian state and that Israel is occupying part of it?
Oh, this is a brilliant end run on the part of the Palestinians. There's no doubt about it. The negotiations, direct negotiations, have broken down. The Israelis really don't want to enter into serious direct negotiations with the Palestinians. So what the Palestinians are doing is something that hasn't been, that's only been done twice. What they're going to do is they're going to bring the issue of Palestinian sovereignty to the Security Council, where undoubtedly it will get defeated. The United States will probably use its veto in order to defeat it. Although there's an outside chance that the United States could get seven members of the Security Council to vote with it, but that's not likely at all. Then what will happen is something called a Unity for Peace resolution. In other words, the Palestinians will then take it from the Security Council to the General Assembly. And at that time, what they'll do is to get the General Assembly with a hopefully a two-thirds vote to vote for Palestinian sovereignty. As I said, this has been done twice before, where issues of import that have been blocked in the Security Council have been taken to the General Assembly. The first time was the Korean War, and the second time was over the issue of Namibia. The Palestinians need a two-thirds vote in the General Assembly. According to their count, they already have pretty close to 60%. 112 countries have announced that they will recognize Palestinian sovereignty within its 1967 borders, with East Jerusalem as its capital on the one hand, and there's a total of 192 members of the General Assembly. So they're on the verge of being able to pull this off.
Again, Jim Galvin is with as professor of history at UCLA. Laura Rosen, back to you. How has the Obama administration prepared to deal with this one?
Well, what I've been hearing recently is that the Obama administration's thinking of Obama giving a speech asserting U.S. kind of vision for the basis of resolving the Israeli-Palestinian dispute about 3 weeks before that Palestinian effort at the United Nations, so maybe late August. The idea would be that this is a speech that would probably be too give too much land to the Palestinians than the Israelis would like, but putting it in the context of something that's already coming to happen, that's about to happen at the UN, may ease Israeli frustration with the Obama administration, while possibly, if not giving the Palestinians a reason to abandon their bid at the UN, convince key countries in the quartet, the Europeans, to consider possibly supporting the U.S. effort as opposed to voting for Palestinian statehood at the UN at that time. Personally, I think that the bid will fail. You've not seen European nations indicate. They are very frustrated with the lack of progress in the peace process, and frustrated a bit with the Obama administration as well.
Is the U.S. worried? Is the Obama administration worried that it's losing influence in that region?
I think it recognizes that it's losing influence in the region. And, you know, for instance, on the Syrian violence, you have not seen the administration, you know, assert that Assad has lost legitimacy or that he should go. And I think one reason for not doing so is they don't think if he said it, it would happen, you know. And to say it and for it not to happen could be a victory for, groups like Hamas and Hezbollah in Iran that the U.S. doesn't want to be empowered. So I think, you know, the Obama administration has recognized the limits of their influence in parts of this conflict.
Laura Rosen again at Yahoo News. Still with us, Professor Jim Galvin at UCLA. Do you think that the U.S. is losing influence in the Middle East?
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt about it. And it's not just whether the Obama administration acknowledges or not, but the Palestinians have obviously looked at the American position, the loss of American prestige in the region, the loss of America's ability to effect change in the region, and have calculated that into their moves. There would not have been a Palestinian reconciliation had the Palestinians took the American position as seriously as it had been pre-2003, for example. And this whole idea of bucking the United States, which is the largest donor to the Palestinian Authority, of bucking the United States and going instead directly to the United Nations is certainly an indication that the Palestinians are looking over their shoulders. There's one other thing as well, though. The Arab Spring has made it so that the Palestinian leadership is not only looking at the shift in the balance of power in terms of forces such as the United States and Iran and so on and so forth, but looking at its own population with a certain amount of trepidation. At the top of the Palestinian leadership, you have two sets of dinosaurs. You have Fatah on the one hand, Mahmoud Abbas's faction, that was established in the 1950s or so, and is very 1950s in its orientation. You have, on the other hand, Hamas, which is very 1980s in its orientation. In the meantime, what you have is bubbling up as a result of the Arab Spring and other factors taking place is a youth generation now that is saying a plague on both your houses, a plague on Israel's house. This is what we want. We want now an end to this crisis, an end to the Israel-Palestine conflict. We want to have greater democracy at home, and we want you to be able to deliver on an end to corruption.
Again, Jim Galvin is professor of history at UCLA. Muin Rabbani is independent Palestinian analyst. He's based in Amman, Jordan. He's a familiar voice to our listeners, and it's good to have you back on our program.
Good to be here.
What do you say to what we just heard? Two dinosaurs now challenged by a younger generation with very different ideas about what the future ought to look like.
In general, I agree. I would just make the observation that unlike many of these other political systems in the Arab world, the Palestinian political system is much more deeply entrenched and, for all its faults, also has a much higher level of legitimacy among the general population than many of its Arab counterparts. And what that means is that the room on the margins for example, youth activists and so on, to launch a real challenge to this movement is probably much more restricted than it is in many Arab states. Having said that, I do agree that there is a new form of politics emerging among Palestinians as well, and this has two factors. Some of those relate to what we just heard from Professor Galvin and your other guests. The other one, I think, is that the Palestinian leadership is finally beginning to put what I would call this entire charade of the peace process behind it. When you think about it, you know, Obama's achievement is quite miraculous, Mahmoud Abbas, for whom negotiations were more or less a religious faith, Obama has actually managed to convince him not only to threaten alternatives, but to actually pursue them. And I think it's the combination of disillusionment that anything meaningful is going to come out of U.S.-sponsored diplomacy on the one hand, and the Palestinian dimensions of the Arab Spring on the other, that are accounting for what we're seeing now.
You're suggesting that President Obama intentionally persuaded Abbas to pursue alternatives to the peace process?
No, I don't think it was intentional at all. I think it was as a result of constantly deflating expectations, leading Abbas by the nose on the whole issue of a settlement freeze, once, not once, but not twice, but three times, by basically failing to deliver anything meaningful in the context of having raised the hopes sky high at the very beginning of his administration, and then delivering nothing except an embrace of Netanyahu's positions.
Muin Rabbani, once again, independent Palestinian analyst based now in Amman, Jordan. On Friday, the prime minister, current prime minister of Israel, will be here in the United States. And as we heard earlier, the president will be addressing AIPAC on Saturday. That's the very powerful Israeli lobby in Washington. Uri Dromi, another familiar voice on our program, was a spokesperson for Yitzhak Rabin, the late Israeli prime minister. He's also served in the Israeli Air Force for 25 years. And Uri Dromi, thanks very much. Always good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
What do you say to what we just heard, that there's a very different kind of politics now? I guess that was reflected by the defense minister, Ehud Barak, when he said that this massed Palestinian idea of going unarmed to the border rather than engaging in suicide to bombers was a change. But what about what we've heard since then and the kinds of challenges just referred to by Muin Rabbani?
I think we shouldn't be too edgy about the events. I mean, the fact that Palestinians came to the border and mentioned the Nakba, in a way, it's a good thing. I think all of us here, when we celebrate, for example, the Israelis celebrated a few days ago their Independence Day, people should be reminded that there was a catastrophe for the other people. If we are going to live next to each other in two states, friendly states, I think we should have respect and recognition of each other's history. Having said that, Israel is determined to protect its sovereignty. And again, coming back to what Mr. Barak said, all we've seen around us, I see it as an opportunity rather than a problem. I see a way in which the Arab Spring, and especially the emergence of youth among the Palestinians, is something which Israel can benefit from and help promote it as an active partner rather than passive, which unfortunately is what we have now.
In the meantime, what about what is expected to happen at the UN in September? Does that change the moral situation to some extent if the UN declares that there is, in fact, a Palestinian state based on the 1967 borders with East Jerusalem as its capital? Or would that be an embarrassment to Israel or not?
Well, it's up to us to a certain extent to decide whether it's going to be an embarrassment or, again, an opportunity, because it was Mr. Netanyahu himself who said in his Bar-Ilan speech that there should be two states, a Palestinian one and Israel, living next to each other in friendship. And therefore, this is what's going to happen in September. So instead of embracing it and working with the Palestinians to accomplish it, we are now seeing a situation in which Israel is isolated, and there's a lot of finger pointing and accusations, etc. In the meantime, what's going to happen is that in September there will be probably a resolution by the UN, and therefore I would encourage Mr. Netanyahu when he comes back to use the three remaining months to work with Mahmoud Abbas, to have a a settled agreement rather than being dragged screaming and yelling to this conclusion.
What about Hamas? Mr. Netanyahu has said he won't negotiate with Hamas, and Hamas and pardon me, and the and Fatah, led by Mahmoud Abbas, have indicated that they're now part of the same government.
I think we should put the onus on them. When Hamas took power in Gaza, I wrote a piece called "Blessing in Disguise," because if this is the face the Palestinians want to put, bless them, because then we know exactly whom we're talking to. Now there is this mixture of Fatah and Hamas. Let them sort things among themselves and let Hamas subscribe to the conditions of the quartet, which is recognizing Israel and stopping terrorism, and then we can deal with them. If not, then Mahmoud Abbas, by partnering with Hamas, will doom the whole Palestinian enterprise. And unfortunately, we've seen this happen before.
Let me go back to Jim Gelvin, our professor of history at UCLA. In the New York Times today, on the op-ed page, Mahmoud Abbas, the leader of Fatah, has laid out his rationale for going to the UN. He's also said that he wants the membership in the UN and pursuit of allegations against Israel in the International Court of Justice. Is that going to do the Palestinians much good, that kind of demand, as they approach the idea of negotiations with Israel?
That's a shot across the bow, clearly. The idea of sovereignty does in terms of the United Nations vote is that it gives the Palestinians the same rights and privileges that it gives to any other sovereign state. And that includes, for example, being able to make a case in the International Court of Justice. It means, for example, its ability to file complaints with human rights organizations, international human rights organizations, et cetera, et cetera. This is Abbas sending a very clear message of the implications and how far the Palestinians are willing to go once this sovereignty issue has been put on the table.
Uri Dromi, does that create an opportunity for Israel, or is that something Israel ought to be worried about?
Yes, I think when Netanyahu spoke about two states, okay, let's say September creates the Palestinian state. Then let's sit down with them and talk. I mean, if they're going to take us to The Hague, you know, and start all these kind of things, it will only harden the positions of the Israeli, which many of them are now leaning to the right, and it's going to cause more complications. So I think once there is a Palestinian state, things might be even easier. It sounds paradoxical, but this is the case. Here you have two states, and we have a border dispute. Let's sit down. Let's talk. I've been there when Rabin sat with King Hussein and they sorted the sensitive and difficult border issues, and we did the same with the Egyptians. In a way, it creates opportunities. Let's not only think about the problems.
All right. The president did indicate today that he thinks that the political change in the Middle East ought to be accompanied by some kind of assistance from the West. We'll see what he says on Thursday. Meantime, thanks to you all. Uri Dromi, a veteran of Israeli politics and the military, Muin Rabbani, our Palestinian in Jordan, Jim Gelvin at UCLA, and our earlier guest, Laura Rosen with Yahoo News, and Joel Greenberg with The Washington Post in Jerusalem. That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point. Which Way LA was produced tonight by Sonia Geis, Karen Radziner, and Katie Cooper. Our supervising producer is Gary Scott. Our technical director is Mike Newport. You can email us or share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/whichwayla. Or join the conversation on Which Way LA's Facebook page. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.